Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. It's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we are going to be talking about alcohol. Who's been touched by it? Who hasn't been touched by it? Who thinks it's no big deal? Who says, oh, it's a big deal for me? And furthermore, what are we as each individual doing to contribute to other people? Do we invite everybody over and you sit and you all drink and you say, see you later, and everybody goes home and drives and you never know what happens to them? Or do we say, oh, it's not a big deal in our house, this is the way we celebrate? Well, do you celebrate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Today we're going to be talking about what I would always call the good, the bad, the ugly of alcohol. And is there any good? Is there any bad? And what is the really devastating part? Today my guest is Scott Stevens, and he's going to be sharing his personal stories and many of his books that he has written on the topic, as he is very familiar with the subject. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Dr. J, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate what you've done with Wellness Radio, and it's always an honor to be part of it. Thank you.
So, Scott, you know, I think I'm not so sure where we're going. You know, this is 2017. Mm-hmm. You and I have spoken last year. We thought it might have gotten a little better. I can see it's gotten almost exponentially worse this year. How have you seen it?
Well, I've seen the upside potential here with the Surgeon General issuing a report last November, finally for the first time ever talking about the health consequences of alcohol. And you know, we've had this talk before about, you know, when I was born in 1967, 72% of the adult males smoked, and today 72% don't. And that's because a couple of years prior to that, the Surgeon General started the ball rolling with this landmark report on tobacco and tobacco smoke being carcinogenic and all the health consequences. Well, what I saw last fall with our Attorney General Murthy announcing that, you know, for the first time ever, we're going to tackle this alcohol thing in the context of other drugs, because alcohol is a drug. It's like, yay, it's a big time applause for for finally having the courage to do that. So that to me is a very sound message that there's a change, a sea change ahead of us in our alcohol policy in this country, finally treating it as a drug and as the serious drug that it is. But on the other hand, I see exactly what you're seeing as well. There is more acceptance of, for example, alcohol being sold at college football stadiums, which I think is a nutty idea. And we're welcoming it into more corners of our lives where, you know, on one hand, you've got the Surgeon General saying, hold up, folks. And on the other hand, you're saying, let's sell it everywhere, every time, a day, and in every venue that we can. So the two messages are diametrically opposed, and they're slamming into each other out there.
You know, what I really look at it, though, is we've seen this over and over in healthcare and in politics. Oh, yeah, let's just put that out there. We know it's good, bad, or wrong. But, you know, on the other hand, they're pulling the glass out from behind their back, and they're sitting down and having lunch with four and five drinks at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So while I look at it and I say, you know, we've all potentially could say we're meaning people, and we would like to see it stop. We'd like to see things change. We would like to see, you know, all of this other stuff go on. But if we actually had to look at our own habits, our own things that we do, how we celebrate, how we sit down and we have something, a drink at the end of the day when you're stressed or relaxed or whatever, I think most people, and I'm almost saying, and I know this for a fact, we could probably say it's well over 80% of the population now does do it. They have drinks for all of those various reasons. And do they really want to see it go away? Probably the answer would be no.
No, and you know, I'll say this from the outright. I am not a prohibitionist. I don't think that it serves any good purpose, whether it's political or health-wise, to ban the drug alcohol. But I do think we need to have a serious sit-down discussion across political sectors, across healthcare sectors, and you know, just across our own dining room table to talk about what this drug is doing to you rather than what you think it's doing for you. And that's what's getting lost in this dialogue at all. I mean, we are a drinking culture. Many cultures are.
Right.
It's engraved. It's part of our spiritual celebrations. It's part of our family celebrations. But does anybody sit back and say, why? No.
Correct. The answer is why, but also, too, we end up saying that, you know, oh, well, I deserve it. It's a benefit. That is what we do. But then the answers are when, you know, people have 2, 3, and 4 and wreck your car, then those people are, like, treated as cast outs. But you've actually helped to propagate that. It's sort of like saying, you know, when my kids are born, you know, I can't wait till they get their teeth because they can have McDonald's French fries. And then, oh, I can't wait to have a birthday party for them. And, you know, they're giving them all this sugar all along. Oh, we're in a hurry. Let's get takeout for every single meal. But then when they're obese, they're yelling and screaming the other way. You know, it's like, oh, somebody else must have done it to me. Dude, you did it to yourself.
And in a lot of cases, you're exactly right, where people will begin to look at the person who has the disease of alcoholism as somebody who doesn't have the willpower or couldn't do it, can't stop drinking.
Right.
And, you know, realistically, we're talking about 12% of the population has the disease of alcoholism. But that doesn't mean this drug is safe for the other 88%.
Correct.
And that's where we need to step back and say, okay, so alcohol turned on me in my 30s and early 40s. So, I have to stay away from it or I'm going to die. I know this. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the more frequently they drink, the earlier they start, or the more that they continue to put this toxin and known carcinogen in their body, they're shortening their life expectancy. So the problem isn't just for the alcoholic, the guy who cannot drink. It is for the people, the rest of the planet. 100% of us shouldn't be putting this toxin into our body. If we knew the damage that the death or the destructive toll that it takes on ordinarily healthy tissues, beginning with cancer and going through a whole list of more than 60 different diseases. This isn't a safe thing. It may be fun for some people, not me, but fun for some people to feel that mind-altering substance. That's what drugs do. But there are consequences to any drug that we put into our body, and this one is not consequence-free.
You know, we look at it, you know, I was talking to someone the other day and they were saying, oh, I went to an event and they had alcohol there and I know that I don't drink and it was on the table and everything, but hey, that makes me stronger. And I'm thinking, no, that's really kind of a stupid comment, because if you have five people, okay, let's say we have five people at the table and they all had cancer from a certain source, like let's say maybe lead or radium or asbestos or whatever, and we put that on the table and we just blew it around in the air and we said, oh, hey, we want you to be stronger. We want you to be able to resist it and not get cancer from this. You would say, people, you really need, well, I don't even get what you're doing. There's something seriously wrong here with what you're saying. But yet when we do with alcohol, we think it's okay, you know? I mean, would you really, if you got cancer from asbestos, would you go into an asbestos-filled room just to prove that you're stronger? I don't think so. You know what
absolutely
I mean?
Absolutely not. And we wouldn't sit and have a snack of lead-chipped paint. You know, but we sit here and, you know, we've made that connection that lead and health are not a good mix. By the same token, you know, the smoking thing. We wouldn't sit down and hand out packs of cigarettes to all of our house guests, but we're willing to hand out the alcohol. And in some cases for example, breast cancer, if a woman has two or more drinks a day, her exposure is the same breast cancer risk as having a pack of smokes a day. So right. Basically, if you're giving her two glasses of wine, it's like giving her a pack of cigarettes, and you wouldn't think of doing that. But we haven't made the connection quite yet. But I'm optimistic. I think we're at the forefront of a sea change here.
I think it's going to take a little bit longer, because what has to happen is that healthcare has to crash first.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the idea of, I think, physicians in the medical communities or the health communities over the periods of history have really come to be heroes. They've come to be lifesavers. Everybody would have pain and things, when people started having a lot of cancer, there was a whole lot more pain in the world. People would start having chronic health issues, as we would define it, so we could have a CPT code to now charge our insurance companies, and they would quote, more people had pain. Then we look at the 90s and the huge push to have pain medications. Now in the years 2000s, physicians are saying, oops, I can't give it to you anymore. So they're kind of turning their back on people that they've kind of put in this place and said, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you just go out and exercise? Why don't you go out and lose 5 pounds? And they walk away, And really what people are starting to do is starting to drink more to get out of that pain, be it physical, be it emotional, be it anything. It could be spiritual or anything. It could be any form of it. So really what's happening is kind of over history we may have created some of these scenarios, but the big deal is that we have kind of bought into them and we still keep propagating them.
And that's especially true of the American culture. We're an avoid pain culture. So that's, you look at the current problem with opioids and opiates, and that certainly plays into it. But in general, we don't like to grieve, we don't like to mourn, we don't like to feel bad. So drinking isn't about feeling good, it's about feeling less bad in a lot of cases. And that is why we choose any kind of mind-altering drug. We don't take drugs to feel good. We take drugs to feel less bad. And that is certainly the case with alcohol.
We always want this quick fix. We are always looking for pleasure. These things that people say, I need you to fake it till you make it. I need you to get to the top as high as you can. Oh, you mustn't be of value because you're living under a street, you're living like a homeless person. So we've totally devalued the value of a human being and put it on the exterior presence of that person instead of the interior, who that person or that human being is. I think we find that playing out in Europe, where a lot of people, they value each other, they value the elders, they value their families all together. In China, you get 4 or 5 generations in the same home. Here, they can't wait to ship them off,
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's an American society that is really out of control, yes?
Yeah, and I think we need to do a better job of looking out for one another. And it's, I look back at the 80s, my high school years and into college, and what a decade of excess that it was and everything. And that's where we got a lot of this me first mentality. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a lot of that part of the 80s has hung around as a way of life, in that, I'm not going to take care of my brother here. I'm not going to take care of my parents or my neighbor for that matter. And, it's probably a little bit of a pessimistic view, but I think there's some realism between both sides of the argument, in that we don't take good care of our neighbor, let alone ourselves. And I think we're fooling ourselves when we believe that we're taking care of ourselves by feeling better with the aid of a toxin and a carcinogen.
Right. So, Scott, can you share a little bit about your path with alcohol? Because it has, you've written about it many times in your books, and share the name of your book. That would be great.
Sure. My first book was What the Early Worm Gets. That came out in 2010, and I began to write about my path to recovery. I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I was a late bloomer. I started drinking heavily in my 30s. I've had my first drink around the age of 14. Unfortunately, that age is lower these days. It's around 12 average-wise, which means some kids are starting way earlier than that.
Right.
But I was at 14. I had my first drink of alcohol with two other buddies, three of us on a six pack, and they had their two beers and I had mine, and they were acting all squirrely. And I looked at them and, had I known then what I know now, I'd know that my body handles alcohol differently because they're acting nuts. And I'm like, why don't I feel like they're acting? So, I'll fast forward the tape all the way through my college years and my early adulthood, my early married years, and alcohol was not a central part of my life. I was a TV reporter, and it was career suicide to be seen out in a bar or anything like that. So aside from just not being interested in drinking, it was not a great thing career-wise. But then I was working for a mutual fund company, and it got to a point where I was entertaining a lot of clients on the company dime, and I was drinking more, and that was entertaining. We took people out for drinks or cocktails or to a show or a sporting event, and there was always drinking involved. Well, red flag came up when my wife at the time asked me to stop drinking, and being on top of the world, a corner office executive with a major mutual fund company, there wasn't anything I couldn't do, including this. So I said, yeah, no problem, I got this. I tried to stop drinking, and that is the day that I realized that alcohol was no longer my friend, because I could not stop drinking. I stopped for about 12 hours. I was shaking, I was sweating, I thought I was going to die. And the reason is because at that moment I knew I was alcoholic. But did I do anything about it? Well, I tried to solve things my way, and I decided to become a maintenance drinker. Figured, if I just take a sip here and a sip there, I'm not going to sweat to death, I'm not going to shake to death, but I'm going to be able to fool a lot of people into thinking I'm not drinking. But that progressed. I switched from beer to Jack Daniels. Great plan right there as well. And before too long, I was drinking 2 liters of Jack Daniels at least every single day. Day in, day out, didn't matter. Day of the week, didn't matter if I had to go to work. I needed this drug in my body to feel normal. And that is what an alcoholic does. So this was my solution, and it all came to a screeching halt. Not too long after that, I drank my way out of that marriage. I drank my way into a second marriage and out of it. And in drinking my way out of my second marriage, I lost my designated driver, and I got behind the wheel, impaired. And I got 4 OWI tickets, DUI tickets in a period of 6 weeks. So not only was my life spinning out of control on a legal standpoint, I still had employment and everything else, but health-wise, I'd almost died twice already. Once from drinking too much, I drank to get on a plane. Who wants to sober up at 30,000 feet? So I downed a bottle of Jack Daniels in the limo ride to the airport, and I passed out in the airport, woke up in an ER with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.612. And for point of reference, 0.40 is what killed singer Amy Winehouse. Mm-hmm. So I was well on my way. But because I'm an alcoholic, I have an extraordinary tolerance, which is, it's certainly not a bragging point, because that tolerance also pushes my exposure to death from overdose, alcohol overdose, to a really thin razor thin line. And then once I almost died from alcohol withdrawal. This is one of only two drug withdrawals that can kill you. And I quit cold turkey. Just stopped abruptly, which is a shock to your system. Your body begins to view alcohol as a survival need. And when your body doesn't get a survival need, it begins to shut down. It's the same thing with not drinking water. After a period of time of not having water, your body begins to shut down. And my blood pressure was 49 over 17 at one point when I wound up again in the ER. So here's my story. nearly died twice, 4 arrests in 6 weeks, sobered up a little bit. And you'd think with all those consequences, that would have been the end of my story or the beginning of my recovery. Not quite so fast, Dr. J. I relapsed. And I was sitting there as I just finished writing my first book, and I relapsed. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with me? Why can't I get this? And I was very frustrated, in a very dark place for myself. And then I began to research more about the disease of alcoholism. I wrote my second book, Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, about relapse and recovery. And we are wired differently. A non-alcoholic will never understand what it's like to drink alcoholically, and an alcoholic like myself will never understand what it feels like to drink for a non-drinker, for a non-alcoholic. And it's because our body chemistry is a bit different. We have difficulty managing serotonin and dopamine, the two brain chemicals, which I'm sure you've talked about on your show. And we also have a higher level of the stress hormone cortisol, and that leads us to be more susceptible to stress. Non-drinkers and drinkers alike drink for the same reason, and that's to relieve stress. And so, I got into more and more about what else is alcohol doing to our bodies. And I became aware of a whole ton of research, good evidence-based research, not some junk science like you find out there on purported health benefits of alcohol, but all these things that alcohol does, even in moderation, to a body, and began to tally up all that and put it into a book. As I wrote my third book about the stigma of alcoholism, Adding Fire to the Fuel, I put more of that in there. And then just this last fall, after the Surgeon General made his report, I released my own follow-up to that, which is, I can't see the forest with all these damn trees in the way. And that was talking about specifically the health consequences of alcohol, because over that period of 7 years between my first book and today, I've come across so much evidence against the use of this drug, even in moderation, that, the warning signs are all out there. They've been out there for decades. And it's not just for me as a person who will die if I drink again because I'm alcoholic. It's for the non-drinker as well. So my writing has taken from my journey to more of an open dialogue with the public about what this drug is actually doing.
Because it's so vitally important, because I think even yourself, while there are other people around you, like you said, when you're going out with a group of people and they're drinking, there's a lot of societal times. I mean, like, almost you can't go to Taco Bell and they serve alcohol. You can go to almost anywhere and alcohol is there. Everybody's asking you, would you like to, waiting for your table, have a seat at the bar. Would you like a drink? All of these different things. And it's out there all the time anymore. And I think we need to be responsible people to say, do I really need to always have this available at my functions or, different things going on? And we see, but they won't come if they don't get to drink. Well, then maybe they don't need to come,
Right.
And I think it's about being responsible people and start saying, do we want a bunch of people who are totally drunk, don't even know their name, they're pushing themselves against each other, they're breaking my furniture, and, that's okay if they puke on my gray couch, because that's what I expect. And then it's called a good party. And you're going, what in the world? Where have we lost some sense of something? Mm-hmm. It's almost like you almost feel like you're in like one of those, those old cartoons, where you just go, I just don't know where I am. I'm almost in an altered state myself. I'm not drinking, right, but I'm looking at this altered state.
On one hand, we as businesses look at alcohol as a revenue generator, right? I'm not spilling any company secrets here. Every restaurant wants you there early and delays your table so you can buy the drinks. And when you're buying the drinks, you're buying the most highly marked up item on their menu. You're paying for the restaurant. So when a retailer, and I'm going to bring up Starbucks, they decided, hey, look, we can add alcohol to our menu. We can draw more people into our restaurants, and we can make a higher margin than we're making on our already overpriced coffee. It's a great plan. You know what? They've backed off on that initiative. And
right.
I think you're going to see people like Taco Bell entering into this initiative thinking it's going to bring in more people and higher margins
right.
when they realize that it's bringing in the wrong people and people who are going to sit there longer. You don't make revenue off of a restaurant with everybody sitting around the same table for 2 hours if you can turn that table over three times in that period of time without serving them booze. So
and it's also the consequences, because people who are drunk abuse mm-hmm. your property.
Yeah, they'll abuse your property. They'll abuse their neighbors, because
yes.
one of the things, when one of the miracles of alcohol is it lowers inhibitions and also
correct.
Increases volumes. So you're going to say some ridiculous stuff, and you're going to say it at a higher tone of voice. But the idea of being somebody in an environment when somebody is getting slammed is not a family environment. And where a lot of restaurants are these days, they want the revenue, but they want to be seen as a great place to go as well. And that's not the case when you switch your menu around to appease the margins.
And also, too, let's talk about the idea of if you have something at your home, or if you go something at a restaurant or a hotel or wherever, and people mm-hmm. leave from there after you've already pumped them full of whatever, no one is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Even the person who gets a DUI these days isn't responsible. There was an accident here recently in the New Orleans area where the woman had four DUIs in the period of 90 days,
mm-hmm.
and the fifth one, she killed somebody. Because she was going the wrong way on a highway, and she killed someone, and she still was out, and nothing happened to her. And we're going,
mm-hmm.
where? What's going on?
Well, there's certainly a liability issue anytime alcohol is served, and I think more
but
states are catching.
But is it a fake liability, or is it just a smoke screen? You know that whole thing. Everything's like it's not real. Everything's hid behind a smoke screen.
Right, and I think a lot of the liability is on paper, and the tooth isn't in the
right.
law. You'll see more parents getting ticketed and fined for having an alcohol-related party, but as far as actually having the daylight sued out of them because a teenager
right.
drank and then drove after their house party, those stories are still rare because the tooth
yeah.
isn't in the law of liability. You hardly ever see, because of the strength of the alcohol lobby and the tavern association, you'll hardly ever see a liquor seller get in trouble for the person that was overserved, got behind the wheel and took out a power pole or took out a family. And that is where, once we begin to put the establishment on the hook for that, you can talk all you want about serving responsibly or not serving a overserved patron. But until the laws have more strength in them, you're basically looking at, as you pointed out, a smokescreen. It's
right.
great on paper.
It's almost looked at as a badge of courage. Hey, everybody got tanked at so-and-so's house. Can't wait to go there next week because, oh my gosh, they'll have twice as much,
Right. And the whole idea of binge drinking certainly
mm-hmm.
has gotten a lot more publicity in the last 5 years because of the health consequences, but also
mm-hmm.
the societal consequences in that, when we have a whole generation of college-age kids who their idea of social drinking is binge drinking. And,
mm-hmm.
That's been going on for generations. It was back in the 80s when I was around, and certainly decades and generations before that. But that is where, this notion of not just having one or two, but having one or two six-packs and drinking to that level of intoxication just to be, entertaining or feel entertained, I guess, is, a concept that was never really familiar to me. But certainly I've witnessed that.
You know, we look at Destin, you know, Destin, Florida. They had an event where they just had enough of the spring breakers, and they just said, we're done. That's it. Mm-hmm. You can't come here anymore. Go away. And they all went this year to San Antonio, Texas. And if we, or not San Antonio, somewhere on the beach in Texas. But anyway, they had it on Fox News, and they said, oh, this is what your kids are doing at spring break. And people, it's like the people said that I was listening to, they said, oh, my gosh, isn't that cool? They're doing just what we used to do. Or, oh, it's no big deal. Let them do it down there. They'll be home. No big deal. But yet they don't understand the concept. In other words, that out of sight, out of mind idea. I think when we use those words out of sight, out of mind, we can use it at all levels of alcohol. People hide it in their cupboards. People hide it from their coworkers. You can hide it from your parents. You know, you can hide it from the police. It's like it's constantly this subversive kind of thing that, you know, hey, do what you want to do, and oh, no big deal, right?
Well, the whole no big deal part of the conversation is what has to change, in that it is a big deal when you're putting something that toxic in your body. Part of the reason is because of the way alcohol is metabolized. It's broken down first into a substance called acetaldehyde. That's where you get all of these serious physical health consequences. The alcohol itself is pretty toxic to the human body, but the acetaldehyde is 30 times more toxic than the alcohol itself. It's a necessary step in the body getting rid of it, but in order to go through that step, and it goes, you know, your bloodstream touches everything in your body, but the initial follow the course of the alcohol down your body through the mouth. Alcohol is the number two cause of oral cancers, esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, liver cancer, all the way through your colon. You know, it does the damage through that, but also through your brain tissue. It alters neurons in your brain, and this alters the molecular structure of your noggin. Okay, that's some pretty potent stuff. And when we're saying, hey, that's all right, we did it when we were kids, we turned out fine. You're missing the point here. We may have turned out fine, but you've also done some damage that is cumulative to your body. The younger you start, the worse it gets.
But also, too, we can also say that the potency of alcohol has increased in the past 10 years, where the alcohol we may have drank in, like, the 60s and 70s is one half of the potency that we have now. I mean, we've got, there's some even topping Everclear these days, and I'm going, how can that possibly be possible, you know? And
right.
It really
is.
I mean, the proof of these alcohols is up to the 200s now.
Well, where we're getting younger generations with these malt beverages that are sweet tasting, they're packed in cans that look like sports drinks or energy drinks like Monster. Well, we're putting alcoholic beverages in there now with high potency. I mean, these are in one single can is the equivalent of three or four cans of beer worth of alcohol. Mm-hmm. But we've got this fruity flavor in there, and we're making a very obvious play to a younger generation who doesn't have the taste buds for a good scotch or know the difference between good wine and bad wine. They're getting loaded on what are called alcohol pop or alka-pops. And I've done some work with Alcohol Justice out in California. That's a big initiative of theirs. And, to have that strength of alcohol specifically marketed to young people sets a really bad precedent. But you're right, on the other end of the spectrum, you look at a few decades ago when Jägermeister became the rage in the taverns. Well, that stuff is potent. I mean, if you were thinking about drinking a rum and coke and then follow it with a couple of Jäger shots just because everybody else is doing them, the subsequent toll to your blood alcohol concentration and the rest of your health, obviously, is pretty severe.
I mean, we can think back to Boone's Farm. I mean, like, you know, I mean, how far back was that and how weak was that, you know? But yet, everybody nowadays is like, how you have to add these, they compound. They're getting better at chemistry, you know. They're compounding things to have a exponential effect, and it's really kind of really getting off of the wall these days, you know, as we would see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely an effort on the part of manufacturers to increase not just the quality of a wine or a beer, you know, flavor-wise, but to increase the potency as well.
So we talked about that it's so not good for you. We talked about all of the events and all of the places we see it happening and how we'd like to see those shift and what it really does do to your body and people. I think I want to touch on this for a second here about what it does to your body. People think, oh, it just makes me feel funny and, whatever. And you think about it, your skin smells like it. You eke it out. You breathe it out. There's not a – you could put your body in a big vacuum and say, which part is not touched by alcohol? And the answer is zero.
Right.
You know? And yet we think – I think sometimes we have this mentality – and this comes along with a lot of pharmaceutical drugs and stuff, is that the pill goes to a certain spot to affect a certain thing that's wrong with my body, and it doesn't do anything to the rest of my body. And then we all know that that's a fallacy in the certain realms of people, but most people think that that's still true. So I kind of think that they take that concept, and when you're saying, oh, but I take my drug for cholesterol, and it just pulls out my cholesterol. Yeah, I don't think so, you know?
No.
And then they say, oh, but, you know, you're saying alcohol's a drug. Well, it just makes me feel stupid and doesn't do anything else. So we really have to understand that those are both very exactly the same situations. However, what you need to realize is that you're treating them with the same abundance of ignorance, you know, by denying that which is really true versus what you believe is to be the truth.
Right. And the separation of fact from fiction here is really paramount to our way forward in this. We have to begin talking about this not as a drink, not as a social lubricant, not as something that, you know, we can get at every bar or every grocery store or every gas station for that matter, but that this is a drug. And every drug, even something as innocuous as aspirin, does affect every part of your body. This being a very particular, very volatile drug, has health consequences beyond just getting a buzz, and health consequences way far past DUIs, car wrecks, and cirrhosis of the liver. Because that acetaldehyde, that byproduct of the alcohol, is touching every system in your body. So there's nervous system damage, central nervous system driven by your brain. You don't want to mess with your gray matter. And in fact, you are changing it at a molecular level. You are creating a chemical imbalance within the brain between the serotonin and dopamine. You call this a mind-altering drug because that is the first place you feel it, and it's also the place where you do a considerable amount of damage. Some of the damage is reversible with abstinence, but some of the damage is cumulative and permanent, especially for drinking at a younger age. The other important system in your body, not that there is an unimportant one, but your cardiovascular system. We've always heard this rumor that, hey, red wine is good for your heart.
Right.
Not true. It is, alcohol is terrible for your heart.
Right. Absolutely.
There's a substance in red wine, resveratrol, that does have heart benefits, but by and large, the damage that alcohol does to muscle is cumulative, and the number one killer of drinkers is not car wrecks or cirrhosis. It's heart disease. So if this is good for your heart, geez, I should live to about 200.
Isn't that incredible to think that they would push that? Just, you know, that's misconstrued, you know, media again, you know, and it's misconstrued medical studies. You know, they want to tag the outside thing. They say alcohol is good for you, but we know it isn't. Or just like you said, wine is good for you, but it isn't. It's the factor in the wine, you know, and I think we justify our poor actions, our poor choices, and we justify everything we do anymore with these crazy answers that just because, oh, well, it doesn't matter, don't you think?
It's wishful thinking because we know intuitively that this is not good for you. But and the alcohol industry, they play up on this quite a bit by rolling out their junk science. And I do a daily basis. I'm coming across – I have a news feed that comes in to talk about health and alcohol. And any claims that they're making, I jump out there and I respond to editorials. I respond to the junk science in that it is, in fact, junk science. It's observational studies. Well, this group of people seem to fare well, and alcohol was part of their regular diet. What do they fare well on, and what other components of their lifestyle were you not measuring? And, you know, taking all in an evidence-based study, there is not one single evidence-based study that says alcohol consumption in any amount is good for the human body or has any health benefit, period. It's not been documented. And as much as the alcohol industry would like to rely on junk science and wishful thinking, it's simply not the case. And I think you'll see, or we've begun to see, some backlash to that. You know, the old tale was this old heart health tale was discredited more than a decade ago. Well, some people are still talking about it, but fewer people are believing it.
Right. You know what? Let's talk for a minute about recovery relapse. And we can say, can we stop drinking? How can we find some help? And what happens when we don't succeed, right?
I couldn't stop on my own. I needed help. And I think that's an important part of taking care of one another, in that if we see someone who has a drinking problem or we suspect has a drinking problem, we say something. And you know what? They're not going to want to hear it. But from a drinker standpoint, we have moments of lucidity from time to time, and it makes a difference that somebody says something about the level of consumption that you're on being of concern to them. There's no reason not to. There's no reason to sugarcoat this, because alcoholism is a chronic, fatal disease, and it's progressive. It's not going to get better on its own. You need some catalyst for change. And sometimes it's that discussion that you have candidly with a person. Maybe it sticks. Maybe they become resentful, but at least the message was heard. The second point is to realize that recovery is possible. I work with an outfit called Addicted Minds. We have a treatment center directory. And there are a lot of very good treatment centers out there that will work with your insurance, and in some cases, even if you don't have insurance, they will work with you to make sure that you're getting the treatment we all deserve. I mean, this is a very serious disease. It affects 12% of the population. Excuse me. But every one of us has an impact on at least another 8 lives. So, I mean, that there's a lot at stake here. It's not just getting the alcoholic well, it's getting the family well, and putting them on a continuum of care, not just that 28 days that they're in treatment. And that's part of what we do with Addicted Minds, is to connect people that are looking for treatment with facilities that have been thoroughly vetted, and to make sure that that is an open and a welcome and an immediate alternative, because sometimes when you get to that moment of yes, you've got to act right away or you're going to miss the opportunity to get that person healthy. And that applies for any drug, whether it's alcohol or opiates or marijuana, cocaine, et cetera.
There were a lot of these shows on TV. They were talking about, they would always show rehab and stuff like that. And those shows have gone away because people would say they were too, they had too much drama. They had too much, they were too real. Those people were acting out for TV. And what you and I would really turn around and say, that's only a fraction of what really goes on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I know even myself, you know, gosh. Over the decades, let me tell you some things that could go on, you know? And you and I, if we ever sat down and were truthful about all of our stories, we could probably be on the radio here for hundreds of hours. And people
True.
Would say, you're crazy, that's not what you saw. And it's, we've seen these things happen, you know. So I think for everybody to understand, too, is that when people start to want to get help because they know themselves that they need help, that really takes on a whole community, a family, a job, everything that needs to change, because it could be your work that's pushing the booze also more.
Mm-hmm.
It could be your family, you know. I mean, you could send someone off to, you know, a daily recovery program, you know, 8 to 5 every day. They come home at night and everybody's drunk in the living room, you know.
Right.
And stuff like this. So there's really, it's not a solo journey unless the solo journey is really what you want it to be. And I think sometimes the solo journeys are the ones that really have lasting results, because what happens is that people just say, I'm of more value than anything in this world, and they really continue to keep trying, don't you think?
And to that end, they're finding like-minded people who live that same way. So they're not really solo in that they've set themselves apart from their old way of life, their old family, the old friends. We in 12-step circles, we refer to them as people, places, and things. And those ones attached to your old life might be part of the relapse in waiting that you have. So when you begin to change those things, you're setting off. Sure, it may feel like solo, but at the same time, you're gathering a whole new network and a whole new community of like-minded people who are on the same page. And that is, to me, the unbeatable value in any kind of treatment, regardless of the modality that you choose, in that you become affiliated with a helping network, with people you know are going to have your back for real, and that you can rely on, that you can call on, not a superficial one that's only there when you're drinking and doesn't want to hold your hair back when you're throwing up or come visit you in the hospital or prison or come to your funeral. These are real people who are going to be there, and that to me is the ultimate value in any type of recovery effort, in that you have that kind of solidarity of people who've walked in the same darn shoes you've been in.
And it's also a journey, as I would say, as the solo journey. It's a solo journey to yourself, to understand what you're made out of, to understand.
Bingo, exactly.
Right, to understand what you're made out of, to understand how powerful you are, to understand how unpowerful you are, to understand we didn't get drops from storks, that God does have your back all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, senses, and out there. You just have to think a little bit differently, and you 100% have to change your perspective on everything in your reality. So if you think that a birthday is booze, you have to change that perspective. If you think that being happy all the time is a requirement to being a successful person, you need to change that perspective. So there's a lot of things in your perspectives that you need to change and say, you know what, I can be unhappy today and I'm just going to sit here and cry today. And okay, so we slip into a little bit of something else. I'm going to be sad, I'm going to have a pity party. Okay, but you didn't drink today, did you? No. So then you say, oh, okay, so I can have happy and I can have sad. And both of those did not have to equal a drink or to pull me out of it or to put me into it. So I think it's really an experiment about, once you stop drinking, it's an experience in emotions. You'll have every single one of these emotions, and those emotions will test you to see, are you going to put us into that space or are you going to pull us out of that space using alcohol? So I think it's, you know, they kind of run away from them. They say, I don't want to have that experience of being sad or mean or angry again. And that's not really the point. The point is have those, but see what you do with it.
Right. And I love the way you put that. I mean, this is absolutely about self-discovery and learning, learning what got you where you were, but also discovering those emotions. It's really ironic. My fiance last night shared with me this YouTube video of Ozzy Osbourne talking today in 2017 about a plane crash that killed his guitarist back in the early 80s. I believe it was 1983. And that man was still raw. And I turned to Tracy and I said, look how raw he is today. Is there any question why he still struggles with his sobriety at times? Because he is... He gets in touch with those emotions, and he goes berserk. I know in my own situation, when I lose touch with my emotions or try to bury them, what did I do in my last episode with this? I try to drown them, and that ain't cool. And that's not a good outcome for me. And I think as we go through this period of self-discovery, we begin to unfold a lot of things that are painful. But as I wrote in my second book, we need to talk about the things we don't talk about, or else they're going to come back, and they're going to come back uglier, and they may come back with a gravestone attached to them.
And you know, it's also too about being able to speak about them enough times till they lose the quote power over you, and you realize at the end of it, when you speak about it again after that, is that they never did have the power over you. It's you that gave them the power. And that is a big difference because when you say, well, I'm angry at that person, and you're angry at them all the time, and you talk about them, and you're angry about them all the time, and then you just – and I say to some people, sit down and be angry. Close your doors to your house. Be angry for 24 hours. Don't stop. Every single second. Don't turn on the TV. Don't go lay down. Don't do anything. Just be angry at that person for 24 hours. When they come out, they're like, man, after 2 hours, that was just enough of that already. You know, I'm done with that. So in other words, I think it is so important to walk through things, not around them. So important to walk through things and never hide them. And it's so important to walk through them and never, ever, ever give them a different name or reframe them, because that emotion that was attached to them will consistently keep bombarding you.
Yep.
Go to the other side of it and then say, oh, okay, I'm done with that.
It's great on the other side. Trust me on this. It is murder to get through. But I am living my best life ever. And, the things that I thought made me happier, made me a person, really weren't really me. And now I'm being me, and I'm cool with that.
Yeah. Let's talk in closing about the people who cannot give up alcohol. We see this with elder care. People won't go into nursing home or get the medical help they need because they don't want to show or be seen, being the alcoholic person. And then we also look at the others, too, who are trying to do it, but yet they're in a system or a family or they're not able to get that help. And to me, what I say to everybody is if you want help, it's out there. If you want better help, keep asking. If you want to change yourself, sorry, hang on. If you want to change yourself, keep going. If it takes 50 programs, if it takes 100 people, if it takes no matter what, do what it is and just keep going. But if you wish to stay in that space, take no prisoners. Don't pull your family down with you. Don't pull others down with you. Don't require that your kids get in the car with you when you're drunk. Stop taking prisoners and own up to yourself. And if you want to drink yourself, we can't stop you. That's your choice. But take no prisoners. And I think that's really important.
And getting that help, knowing that doing it yourself is not the best recipe. It's time and time again, any alcoholic support group is going to tell you you're not alone. And the fact is, you're not alone when you reach out for help. If you try to do it yourself, if nobody else is in on this, then you're not accountable to anyone, nor are you healing what needs to be healed. And I think that given that accountability and that community is a real value. And, if somebody is really struggling with it, just you keep the fight alive, because you know, this is a relapsing disease, and I'm not using that as an excuse to go out and drink again, but it's not a reason to quit just because you relapse. You don't say, well, see, I can't quit, so I'm going to just keep on using. No, it's like diabetes. I mean, diabetics have a over 70% relapse rate, and diabetics don't just go out and gorge themselves on sugar after one relapse. Excuse me. They keep with the protocol. They keep with the program, and that's what you have to do as an alcohol or other drug user as well.
Right. Yeah, it's all about just being true to yourself and do the best you can. And I've always said that there are never failures. There are never mistakes. It's just experiences in the world. And if we can really stick to that and say, I'm having an experience, it's not a good one, and by no means it might take me out, but it's not a good one. But, you know, by giving yourself the courage or the value to say, I recognize it, I think that's always the first step. We've always said that. You know, what is the first step? The first step is to recognize that, mm-hmm. you have made a mistake. You may have other things that have happened to you. All of this is there, but you're still a person. You still have value. You still have a heart. You still have a soul, and it's still a good thing. You know, when the sun comes mm-hmm. up in the morning, you know, it doesn't say, oh, my gosh, I poured on everybody yesterday. I should be really extra nice today. No. Heck no. That sun just rose up because it just does it, you know.
That's what it does, yeah.
Yeah. So every day, just get up and do what the do is supposed to do, you know.
Exactly.
It's such a different thing.
And as the 12-steppers put it, it's living life on life's terms, because you're never going to live it on your terms. Yeah. And nobody has that luxury. And, you know, the better at it you are without the mind-altering substance, you know, then, you know, there is that promise in recovery that you can deal with life on life's terms. Doesn't mean you're always going to like it. You know, not every day that I've been sober has been a great one, but it beats the alternative.
Yeah, I'll tell you, these gurus out there that are saying, follow me, this is what it should be. I want to just, like, boot them in the butt sometimes.
mm-hmm.
Don't you? It's like, gosh, people, stop already, you know. Get them off your social media. Don't hang on to them. They're not doing you any good.
Yeah, it's poisoning the well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Scott, it has been such a pleasure to have you with us. Could you share a little more about how people could find out information about yourself and your books? That would be great.
Sure. My books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere that books are sold. What the Early Worm Gets is my first one. Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud is my second. Adding Fire to the Fuel. And the fourth is I Can't See the Forest with All These Damn Trees in the Way. I've got a website out there. It's alcoholologist.com, and all the information on my books is out there. If you want to look me up on LinkedIn or alcoholologist.com on Facebook, by all means, alcohol author is my Twitter handle as well.
And, you know, I think, Scott, what you always profess is reach out. And if someone needs to reach out, you've got Twitter, you've got Facebook, you've got a website, reach out. And
please do.
I think, you know, you've always done that, and you've always referred people, and you've helped people and guided them. And I think that's the biggest story, is keep reaching out. So what? Just keep doing it. You know, if you're laying down and you can't get up, reach out. No matter where mm-hmm. you are on the path, reach out, don't you think?
I think so, and I wouldn't recommend it if it didn't work, and it works.
Absolutely. So. Well, Scott, it was such a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining in this conversation.
Always an honor, Dr. J. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more information, again, about Scott Stevens, the information and the links are on the bottom of today's show page. And please, what we say is alcohol is not a great thing. It is not a rite of passage. It is not something that's great for parties. It's not what everybody does, and you have to join in the fun. You just as well step away from it to take your to the side and say, you know what, that's not really a great thing. You know, maybe I shouldn't be doing that. Maybe I don't need to be riding in that bandwagon. And even still, you know, do the best you can to take care of yourself. Really, Scott and I have both offered so many different topics and help tips today. I hope you're able to find something that works. And please do reach out to Scott. He is always there, Twitter, Facebook, websites, books. Pull everything down. If you have someone that's struggling, pull the information and start getting help somewhere. So thank you so much for joining us today. There is hope and help after alcohol. Please reach out. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.